Je regrette de ne pouvoir donner cette conférence en français, mais je suis confiant que vous me comprenez mieux en anglais. So, the issue of where and how people lived in Urartu has always been obscured by the rather peculiar nature of the archaeological evidence that comes both from texts and archaeology in this land. The kingdom of Urartu was obviously the most powerful rival of Assyria from the 9th to the middle of the 7th centuries BC. And it incorporated an enormous territory in eastern Anatolia. But almost everything that we know about it is something that comes from the top down, from the leadership. Almost every site that we have is a fortress or a castle built by the king, explicitly dedicated by the king, and almost every inscription is written in the name of the king. In fact, if you just looked at it, you would not know that there was more than one Urartian ever living at the same time. Everything is the king. The fortresses include important economic centers where we have massive storage facilities. There's just a few samples. And the power of the state spread with an assemblage of archaeological and literary materials that were, again, bound to the leadership of the kingdom. The Urartians introduced literacy to eastern Anatolia in the form of a cuneiform script that was borrowed from Assyria. But they used it to write their own language. They had distinctive styles of art. They had bureaucratic devices, such as seals and clay bulli. There was a distinctive pottery, which is most characteristically seen in red polished ware, either highly polished or less well polished. And all of these artifacts appear when the state appears. They spread where the state spreads. And they die when the kingdom dies. Literacy evaporates in eastern Anatolia after the Urartians, and it doesn't come back for quite a while. So essentially, we know a lot about the leadership of this society, but we don't know very much about where most of the people were living and under what circumstances. So what about the cities? What about the where were the bulk of the population living? When Elizabeth and I couldn't work in Iraq for 15 years or so, we wanted to explore these obscure aspects of this particular society and weigh them against what we knew, or what the models that we had from working in Mesopotamia about how settlements were organized, contrasting this very different society, which is clearly a territorial state, with the city-state-based societies of Mesopotamia. So the questions I want to ask today are, where did the majority of the Urartian population live? Were these Urartian settlements that we have planned by governing authorities, or were they created by decisions of individuals incrementally over time? Who lived in these citadels who lived in these cities that are beside the various citadels? What was their relationship to the state? And were the elites living centralized, or were their houses dispersed among the residences of the village itself? What I'm going to do today is start by talking about what was known before we did our work in Urartu, what we can say about settlement, and then devote most of this lecture to looking at the city that surrounds the citadel of Ionis in eastern Turkey. But let's start with a text, one that you have here in Paris, I'm envious to say. This is the letter written by Sargon II of Assyria to the god Ashur on the completion of his eighth campaign in 714 BC. It was apparently written quite close to 714 BC because it does not include information that it would have included if it had been written a few years later. For instance, Sargon does not mention the death of the Urartian king he was opposing, whereas his annals say that that king killed himself shortly after this campaign. So this is probably written very close to the time of the eighth campaign. And Sargon marched through a part of Urartu on this campaign, and he describes the countryside in great detail. In fact, this is the most detailed record that we have of an Assyrian campaign. It's a very poetic text, and it gives a portrait of the countryside at this particular time, which, by the way, is a time for which we have almost no archaeological evidence. There's very little that we can say absolutely dates to the time of Sargon. Now, we would be better able to analyze this, what this tells us about Urartian settlements, if we knew exactly where Sargon went. Very few people, I think, still subscribe to this long route that was proposed by Thoreau d'Angin when he published the text for the first time in 1912. And of course, when he was doing that, almost nothing was known archaeologically about Urartu. In any case, the text is structured in such a way that Sargon marches. The campaign was originally directed to a different area. He starts off by going east from Ashur. He comes out, he fights a battle against the Urartian king who comes out of Urartu to meet him, defeats the Urartian king who runs away, and then Sargon marches through these five districts or provinces, the Assyrian term is Nagu, and each of these provinces is separated from the other by some natural feature, a mountain pass, a river, something like that. And into each area, or in each area, there are very few named sites, castles. They're fortified, either fortified cities or they're fortresses. Then surrounding those few named places, there are scores of smaller settlements designated Alani Shalimtishu, settlements in the vicinity. And these are never given a name, and Sargon just simply says he destroyed them in great quantities. Now, this is the way I reconstruct the route, and there are some people who believe me. Others would make a much shorter route, which would have the entire campaign taking place south of Lake Urmia. I don't like that reconstruction because if you do the whole campaign that way, there aren't five identifiable provinces that would be culturally Urartian that he would go through. So I like this because you can match the provinces very well with the agricultural areas in northwestern Iran here. If you identify the provinces as such, you have about the right number of named sites. But the point I'm trying to make here is that you don't have any archaeological trace of these settlements in the vicinity. And it's not for want of survey. Archaeologists have been over this area paying a great deal of attention, looking for small settlements, tells, and things like that. And there simply isn't the density. There simply aren't any small tells, frankly, or very few, that would match up to this description that Sargon has given us. Now, there are a number of possible reasons for that, one of which is that they were simply very small, perhaps individual structures. The Sumerian determinative Uru can stand for anything from a large city to a single dwelling. So it may be that they just aren't large enough to leave any trace. Another suggestion that I made a while ago, I don't know that anybody believes it, is that perhaps these Alani Shalimtishu are simply the structures, the buildings that are surrounding the major citadels. Not villages as such, but simply isolated places that might house a single family or more. In any case, the only site where we actually have any housing that dates to the 8th century was excavated by Soviet excavators, Soviet and Armenian excavators at Argishtihinili in southern Armenia in the 1960s. And the actual pattern of settlement there is that they have a bunch of houses stretched out along this ridge, a few of them outside of the main perimeter of the site, which are between two fortified areas. There's one castle here, and there's another castle over in this direction that isn't quite on the plan. Not much was found there because it was badly destroyed. But it seems that these, the houses are in a saddle area between the two things. And these houses are magnificent. They're freestanding houses. They come in both with both external buttresses, which many feel are indicative of public buildings, that is to say, citadel architectural types, but also without them. But you can see from these plans that we're looking at quite substantial houses. And of course, the number of people who could have resided in these houses is tiny compared to the number of people who must have been associated with these large fortress sites. Now I want to talk a little bit about this problem of centralization and planning. And I want to start with two modern models. This picture here is of a Turkish settlement of a type called a toki, which is built by the state. I'm seeing it from the heights over Ionis. It's a long telephoto lens, that's why it's so shadowy. But you can see that somebody has laid out this plan in a grid and built identical houses. And this is a government operation. I think the people who live here are actually employees who are working at a prison that's somewhere around. But it's state-sponsored housing. And the opposite extreme is something that looks like this. This is a village that has grown up beside an Urartian fortress. I'm taking it from the Urartian fortress itself. And you have houses that are sort of thrown together, not according to plan, some being abandoned, some being created quite recently, but a complete mixture and more or less complete chaos. And the question is, where do these Urartian settlements that I'm going to look at in a moment fall along this scale? Well, the idea that perhaps the Urartians were planning at the same level as the modern state-sponsored Turkish settlements was stimulated by a site known as Zernaki Tepe, which was discovered in the 1950s and published in the early 1960s by Charles Burney. Site was, if it was occupied at all, it was occupied for a very short period of time. There's very little living debris to be found. But you can see the nature of the plan. This is what Burney mapped out he was doing this with an instrument. So this is a real plan. He initially published it as a sketch plan. And this is a photograph taken a few years ago where a lot more of it was preserved than is preserved today. But in any case, there's no question here about planning. And Burney suggested that it was Urartian, and it went into the literature as an example of a planned Urartian site. It looks a lot like this is the Turkish place again, where you can see they planned everything down to the color of the houses and the patterns here. It's all rigidly done, and you get the impression Zernaki Tepe is almost like that. The building plans, the house plans, they're sort of duplex houses. This repeats over and over again. And here you can see it in a modern satellite photo. So something like this clearly has the hand of the state in it. And as long as it was all that we knew about Urartian urbanism, it suggested a very militarily directed idea of what a settlement should be. However, and this is what the whole site looks like in a satellite photo. You can still see some of the grid here, but basically it's deteriorating fast. Recent scholarship has challenged the notion that this is Urartian at all. If it is Urartian, it's absolutely unique. It hasn't turned up at any other Urartian site. And I think it's the evidence is coming in from such things as the discovery of clamps metal clamps between stones in certain buildings, a technique which the Urartians never used, that this site is later. It may be Roman, it may be Sasanian, but there is nothing to link this to Urartu. And with it, the idea that the Urartians are rigid planners of settlements goes out the window. Now, the evidence that we actually have for Urartian settlements, beside that one at Argishtihinili that I showed you, comes from the very end of Urartian history. Rusa, the son of Argishti, who was on the throne at least by 673 as a contemporary of Esarhaddon, and probably ruled as late as 650 or 655, embarked on an enormous building project, creating settlements that were larger than any others the Urartians ever created. And unlike most Urartian kings who would build one citadel, one center, and name it after themselves, Rusa built at least four that we know of. And these are the sites of Kefkalesi near Adeljavaz on the north shore of Lake Van, Ionis, which I'll be talking about a great deal, Carmir Blur on the outskirts of modern Yerevan, and Bastam in northwest Iran, not far from the modern city of Karaziyadin. So these are the only places at which we actually have settlements adjacent to citadels. Other early 8th century sites don't seem to have these settlements, at least the site of Çavuştepe, which is a site on the same order, built by Sarduri II, in let's say the 740s. The Turkish archaeologists who worked there, they looked high and low for a settlement beside that, and they never found one. So it's negative evidence that suggests that, you know, maybe Rusa is doing something a little new here. He's naming several sites after himself. He's scattering these things around in territory that the Urartians controlled pretty well. Ionis is right next to the capital. Whoops. Now what have I done? Okay. Okay, let's go to Carmir Blur. This was excavated by the Soviets beginning at the end of the Second World War. Actually, had one season before the Second World War, and then they got serious about it in 1948-49, and they dug until the 1970s under the direction of Boris Piotrowski. The whole settlement, the whole citadel has been uncovered, so we have the entire ground plan of that citadel. And on the slopes below, areas of housing were actually excavated. Now, this one here clearly is an example of state-sponsored building. You have these regular rooms, identical plan, adjoining buildings, the external buttresses that I mentioned before. All of this is something that some architect planned, and he doubtless had state sponsorship. Also, these places are huge, and I just throw for comparison some satellite photos that I pulled out of adjoining areas. The top are the modern houses of Yerevan, which Carmir Blur is sort of, they're quite near Carmir Blur. And you can see that those houses, even the, which are quite elegant houses, are about half the size of a unit within this thing. And an Iranian village shows completely different arrangement. Once again, we're talking about much, much smaller units. So what's impressive is how big this is and how, let's say, institutional it looks. On the other hand, you have completely different architecture, which is absolutely contemporary with this state plan stuff from the lower town. These buildings, and by the way, they are contemporary. These architecture that looks like this and the architecture that looks like it's rigidly planned, they must have been there at exactly the same time because these sites did not have a long life. They were founded by Rusa II, and they were all violently destroyed, probably within a generation, and in no case was there any resettlement of the area. or at least no immediate resettlement of the area. So, you know, we can be fairly confident that we're looking at a period of 20 or 30 years, maybe 40 years in each case. There's a certain controversy about when Urartu came to an end, but Rusa, the creator of these sites, was also the last king who dedicated any buildings. Some of these are really quite peculiar structures. We get, you know, triangular rooms and trapezoidal rooms, and things look rather thrown together. So this is obviously a very different type of housing. Let's go now to Bostam, this site that was excavated by Wolfram Kleist and the Deutsches Archäologisches Institut from 1968 to 1978. Its name means the little city of Rusa, but it's the biggest Urartian site we know. And it's the main castle buildings are up here. These areas are all storehouses. There's a lot of stuff down here as well. This is our archaeological camp, but there's a building out here that's even bigger that's Urartian. And down on this side of the slope, there is a settlement area. This is the citadel. This is the lower part of the citadel. And this seems to be the main settlement area. Another map showing this settlement here. This, by the way, I mentioned this was our camp, and this is the Urartian Ostbau, which is probably a camp where the Urartian army was. That's the best guess. It's just a huge enclosure without much of anything in it. So what do we have here? Well, again, we don't have anything that looks like the rigid planning, but we don't have quite the same chaos that we saw in the poorer houses at Carmarthen. Several units are laid out together with adjoining rooms. But this area also includes public buildings. This one, in particular, the Hallenbau, appears to be a kind of a royal stable. At least that's the way I interpret it. It has a long, you can't see it in the state of preservation here, but it has a long hall here that is paved on both sides, and this is a classic stable for horses. And this particular room has a very wide door, and back in here there are storage jars for grain that are marked, by the way, with the name of the city. To me, this looks like this is where the royal chariot would have been put, and the horses would be kept, and the special team of horses that would be used would be kept here, and this provides access to go up to the citadel. You couldn't take a chariot up on the citadel, so it seems like this is a logical place to get off and do that. Anyway, that's a public building. This thing out here, whoops, keep hitting the wrong button. This out here is the another sort of palatial building known as the Nordgebäude, regularly laid out. Nothing much in it to say what it is, but it's certainly not a private house. So, you know, we're getting multiple units put next to each other. They include some storage. They include stable areas. These look, by the way, a lot like some of the houses that we are finding at Ionis. So, Ionis has probably the largest number of outlying buildings surrounding the main fortified area here. But this is settlement. There is settlement down in this area, and there's more settlement over in this area. So when we visited the site in 1996, and Altan Çilingiroğlu, the director of the Ege University project here, invited us to join his team and launch a kind of investigation of the entire area of the outer town. We did this not as a separate project, but as part of his project, and we had both Turkish and American, Dutch, I can't remember how many different nationalities we actually had working with this, but it's all part of the larger Ionis project. And we also had an idea of who might be living here, thanks to an inscription that was discovered in 1997 on the facade of this particular temple. The inscription starts here, it runs into the temple, comes back out of the temple, and comes along this thing. It's the longest 7th century Urartian inscription known. And most of the text along here has to do with dedication of the temple itself, the naming of the site. It goes on and on, it's quite long-winded. And then as you come back out here, you have this inscription where you have a bunch of building projects that are being mentioned by Rusa. And by the way, we know Rusa did a lot of building, and we know the names of a lot of sites, but for all the places mentioned here, not one of them is a place we've ever heard of. So we think this may have been done fairly early in his reign before he got around to building Carmir Blur and other places. Hard to say. Anyway, down here, you get this statement. It's Rusa, the son of Argishti, speaks. That's the way they introduce something. And he says, I carried off men and women of the enemy lands. And then he mentions these enemy lands, and it's interesting that he starts off with Ashur. I think it would have been news to the Assyrians that Rusa had conquered them, but never mind. Anyway, he's just saying he took their people. And then Targu, Etiuni, Tabal, Kairuni, Kairanu, Hati, Mushki, and Silikuni. This is the places that we know, it's a pretty good listing of all the places, the major countries that are around the Urartian state. So he's, you know, he's talking about bringing foreign people in. The next statement, which is around on the front of the temple again, off to the right side, reads like this, and it's not entirely clear. He says, there's the Urartian up there, for those of you who want to read the Urartian. And this is Mirio Salvini's translation of it, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense in English, and so I hesitated to turn it into French because it would probably make even less sense. And I think what it is saying is that with the help of these people, presumably the ones he just mentioned, I built the fortress and the settlements. And he puts the fortress and the settlements in the same, on a par with each other. I made this fortress Alzinai. I planned the fortress. So he's talking about, I think, using this labor. And obviously, he would have had to have brought in a lot of labor, because nobody lives in this particular valley. It isn't a rich agricultural area. The modern population of the modern village outside of Ionis is 300 people. And so it's not even a large village. And so he would have had to import a lot of people, and it would seem that, you know, we would have reason to expect to find them in the urban environment around. So these are the main features of the site. There is a natural rock outcropping on which the main citadel, fortress, storeroom buildings are built. There's a terrace over in this direction, which overlooks Lake Van. Lake Van is off in this direction, that is off north. And then there is a slope that goes up from the foot of this rock and rises up to the top of a ridge over here. This is known as Güneytepe. There is also evidence of Urartian settlement down in this area and probably under the modern village, which is over here. We were not able to survey in the modern village. So we did the usual things. We did a shovel test trench where we went every 50 meters along a grid, filled up one of these buckets full of soil, counted the sherds in it, and got a distribution pattern that looks something like this. The size of the circles indicates the quantity of pottery, the colors, the percentage of fine, medium, and coarse wares. This is from a Corona satellite image taken in the 1960s, before there was any work here. This is the citadel area. This is Güneytepe up here. This is Pınarbaşı here. And these are the areas down below on the flats near the lake. This is the area over by the modern village. What's interesting is, in retrospect, this shows a distribution over about a kilometer by a kilometer and a half. We found some of our most interesting things in this area where we didn't find any sherds on the surface. So it just tells you what survey like that is worth. We also did a magnetometry survey, which was very, very useful, particularly on Göztepe, where we had not realized there was any Urartian architecture until we got images that looked like this. Now, there is a lot of noise here, but I think you can probably make out very clear buildings like that one, over here, over here, a series of row-like buildings here, going up here. And I should say that everywhere we dug following this plan, we found things that looked exactly like what we expected, which was very helpful to us when we started digging, because we were interested in, usually when we first started making soundings, we wanted to make small squares that would get both the interior and the exterior of the buildings. The reason we were interested in doing that is these houses were all pretty much swept clean by their inhabitants when they were abandoned peacefully. The citadel, on the other hand, was destroyed in a massive conflagration, as were all the Urartian citadels built by Rusa. They were all destroyed by fire. They're full of wonderful archaeological treasures. The outer towns were not destroyed, and the inhabitants cleaned up. So if we wanted to know anything about what the inhabitants were doing, we'd have to dig the garbage that they threw outside of their houses, which was in the streets, and then we could get faunal collections and other things, and also occasionally find interesting artifacts. In any case, the site to the north, Pınarbaşı, I will not talk about because everything we found there was a public building, and there was evidence of the royal bureaucracy at work in the form of bulli and envelopes. No tablets, but it's pretty clear that this is part of the administrative structure of the citadel itself. The settlement, main areas of housing, were on Göztepe, and we initially start off with a number of soundings that were simply 10 by 10 meter squares, and then in our later seasons, 2008, 2009, we expanded these to try to get whole houses to get a better picture of what things looked like. Now, let's start here in this building, and then we will go up here, here, out here, and finally one that's not on this map, off in this direction. These are the soundings looking from the citadel, going up the hill, and those are the years that we actually dug them. So this was a long project. It took us a while to get back to Iraq, and we were having a good time here anyway. So the lowest, closest area included a large stable, and I think this is very much like that Hollenbau that I mentioned before. This is right at the foot of the citadel. It might be a good place to get off your horse before you go up into the citadel. So possibly that's what's going on. We've only uncovered a very small part of it, and the rest of this we're seeing from the magnetometry. You go up to the next terrace, and you have clearly residential buildings of a different type. They are disappointingly clean, but they have interesting plans. There's a kind of a duplex quality about them, where this room is replicated here. We think this is one unit. This is another unit. There has been some modification, benches and things put on outside, but basically it's a repeating unit. And if you go up here, the magnetometry suggests you get the same thing again. These do have buttresses on the outside. These walls are grounded on bedrock, but when you come out here, the Urartians have leveled off the land and created a platform to hold up the walls, so that they're modifying the terrain to make it sort of step down. Very few artifacts were found here, but we did find at least one semi-luxurious item of a bronze fibula. Artifacts were actually fairly rare in this particular area. The next terrace up is quite interesting because we have several different types of housing here. At the top, there is a well-planned building. An architect designed this. It's a freestanding building. It had a very large stable area, large rooms, and that's one type of construction. The next one down is a very different type of architecture, which everything is thrown together. We can't quite figure out, it's poorly preserved, we can't quite figure out what the circulation pattern here is, but there's several areas which were paved, which would suggest different residential units living within the same complex. And whoever did this, you know, they changed their mind about how they were doing it quite a few times. Oui.
What do the many dots figure out?
They're rocks, yeah. They're just stones. We've sort of outlined the walls, but the dots are all individual stones. This is a kind of architecture that we don't deal with in Mesopotamia, and it's, you know, it's deciding which stones are in place and which ones aren't, which is much harder in the long run than digging mud brick, where, you know, you can follow a line and not worry too much about it. But in this case, a lot of stuff has fallen down. Certain walls have collapsed almost entirely. Anyway, the third building down here, we thought was going to be, for a long time we had only the outer wall exposed. We thought it was going to turn out to be another building like this, and so I had this theory that architects came in and they planned rich people's houses, and then poor people filled in the spaces between them. That may still be true, but this building turns out to be something other than a house, and we'll look at that in a moment. So this is the well-planned one, essentially single entrance, single paved area with a trough beside it, and otherwise more or less clean rooms, although they did have some storage jars and hearths here. At any rate, somebody, and by the way, you can't see it in this plan, but they have types of walls there that are very well constructed. Solid, big stones on the outside with flat surfaces, and the interiors of the walls made up of smaller stones. So it really looks almost, it's not ashlar, but it's almost like ashlar masonry. We also got an association with this from the debris beside it, our only piece of cuneiform writing from the outer town, which is a small bulla with part of somebody's name, in good Urartian, I think. We got a very fine, maybe our finest stamp seal found very near this, and here you see the seal with its impression. This is the building, the next building down, with its chaotic walls, many of them completely collapsed, but you see that there are paved areas here, paved area over here. These rooms up here are actually cut into bedrock, as an example of that. The rock is very soft here, so that they could plane it down, and this is actually a sort of a footing for a wall, but it's carved out of the bedrock. And then the room itself is a shallow area of bedrock. The only industry we can associate with this is cheese making. In one particular place, we found jars that had holes in them for cheese. But all in all, we're looking at a fairly chaotic sort of arrangement. This is an example. Over the years, things fell apart, so it doesn't look in sort of pristine state that when we first dug it, but you get an idea of the thing. And then this final building is part of the largest structure in the outer town. The magnetometer tree shows it going all the way up here and rows of rooms. We only were able to dig this little corner of it. This was on a higher terrace, and the landowner of that terrace did not want to let us dig on his land, so we had to dig down below where people were more agreeable. But what we found was a building with very thick walls, a meter and a half, 2 meters, so quite large. Again, this nice construction, big stones on the outside, little stones on the inside. This is bedrock up here. And this particular room was cut down into what must have been a hole in the bedrock and lined with stones. We have no idea what this thing is. And coming out of this was a lot of very interesting debris, which included bronze horse trappings, salia made out of bone. These are known from other Urartian sites, a cylinder seal or stamp cylinder that had been roughed out but not finished. A strange number of very blue bones. When you look at this stuff with a magnifying glass, it really looks as if they're painted with this blue color. But the general feeling is that, you know, this must be something that's just coming out of the soil. It's hard to say why bones would turn up in this peculiar color. It struck us as odd at the time, and it still strikes me as odd, but I have no explanation for it, because they probably were interred as bones. The most interesting sherd we found came out of this hole, which includes what I interpret as a balance weight, two pan balances here, a cauldron with steam coming out of it, sitting on a tripod, the legs of the tripod just barely visible here. The number, at least 5. And this I see as perhaps a rectangular base with a round top stele on top of it. There are such things in Urartu. Other people say, well, that's just probably a bucket or situla with a handle. I don't know what's going on here, but it's more interesting than the stuff we get out of the rest of the outer town. So, in short, in this area, and this is a composite photo of all of the various pieces, we have that nice building here, a street, this chaotic building here, and then this monumental building of some sort, which is bigger than everything else, which goes up onto the next terrace. A lot is going on in this one. And this, by the way, is the largest contiguous area that we excavated. Let's go further afield. That operation one was there. The first place was there. We're now up here, almost a kilometer away from the citadel. And there we find different houses, solidly but less well constructed. They have a different orientation, not just to the citadel, but to each other. They seem to have been executed, created as separate things. In this area, and only in this area, we found this kind of pottery, a kind of a buffware. And the neutron activation that we did on the clay shows that it is not only not local, but it seems to come from the other side of the Taurus Mountains. In other words, this is Assyrian pottery. I have no idea what it's doing in this area. And the same buildings also have lots of Urartian pottery too. But only in this area do we get this imported Assyrian pottery. Operation 11 was perhaps the most difficult and perhaps the most interesting area that we excavated, spent several seasons there. It's on a very high, sloped part of the mound. And everything is contiguous here. It's the most chaotic architecture imaginable, where you can see many different hands going in to working this. Once again, the circulation pattern is difficult. Some of this is carved out of bedrock. This is solid rock here that's carved. A wall is thrown up next to it. This is a situation where you have stones here leveling out an area, another set of stones here leveling out an area, another set of stones, so forth, as it steps down the hill. And you can see in walls like this the multiple techniques that are being used to build these things. These great big stones at the bottom, some of the walls, tiny little stones in different patterns, sometimes other things sitting on top. But you get the impression that people were constantly rebuilding and modifying this, including this one technique that we had never seen before, where you have large stones at the bottom of the wall, smaller stones on those, and then the wall goes up in packed mud. These aren't mud bricks, it's just packed solid mud. And lo and behold, on top of it, there's another row of stones. And Stefan Kroll of Munich, who was in charge of the Bostam houses, said, yes, we saw that there too. We didn't know what to make of it because we were coming down from the top and we had these walls that were only one stone thick. And then they disappeared and we thought it was all over. And then we came down and the building reappeared. And he said, when he saw this, he said, now I know what's going on. But this is a technique that we don't see otherwise in Urartu. Maybe it's just unusual to have sufficient amounts of it preserved. Usually you don't get anything above the stones. So again, it's not everywhere. It's only in a few places in this building, but somebody's doing something funny. We also found in this building a Pithos sherd, Pithos rim, that has on it an Urartian hieroglyphic inscription. It's one of the few hieroglyphic inscriptions we can actually read. It gives the official units of liquid capacity that are used in the citadel. Very often those are marked in cuneiform. And you have these units, Akarki, Tarusi, and Lish, and they seem to be here as well. Why anybody would need to record this in a place that's more than a kilometer away from the citadel, in what we assume is a private house, I do not know. We found various items, probably more in this particular house than anything else. It's possible that this place was destroyed in an earthquake, so we got a little more here than we get elsewhere. Can't be entirely sure of that, but we have this glazed bottle. Glazes are very rare at this point. I think this is the only one we actually found, but it's definitely associated with the house. We found a nice iron sword, a little bent. A shovel, I don't know if you'd call that a luxury item, but it's odd for us to find a shovel. And a pair of silver earrings that were left together on a floor, hooked together. And nearby, a rather interesting stamp or pendant that gives a winged genie, presumably on one side, and what I interpret as a standing lance here with embellishments that may be representative of the lance of the god Haldi. We know that Haldi is represented as having or being a weapon, and perhaps that's what's going on. I don't know. But at any rate, this remains unique so far. But the most interesting thing that we found was a burial that was put below the floor of the house. It seems to be an adolescent, so that our physical anthropologist can't tell us whether it's male or female, but we strongly suspect it is an adolescent female. And burial, intramural burial, is not an Urartian custom. Usually, Urartians were buried in extramural cemeteries. Very often, they cremated their dead. So something like this is, almost looks like a more Mesopotamian custom than it does an Urartian custom, at least in terms of the interment. But the burial goods are quintessentially Urartian. Child is wearing a bronze belt. Bronze belts are very common in Urartian burials. We know most of them from the antiquities market. But in this case, we actually, for the first time, I think, are seeing somebody wearing one. It's of a style that is usually considered a feminine style, although I'm not sure on what basis. She had earrings. There's the belt. She had numerous earrings, 26, I believe, in all, and they were strung together, coming off of her ear in a kind of a chain on both sides of the head. She had a nice ivory pendant of a small animal eating its prey, and perhaps a dog or a jackal or something like that. But all of this, and this is an absolutely Urartian wine vessel that is being placed in the burial. All of this is, material that we would say this belongs in an Urartian burial. It's just that the burial doesn't belong in the Urartian burial. What we think is that, this is someone who is going only so far in being an Urartian, and then using a separate burial custom. So let's say a person who is not fully assimilated into Urartian traditions, yet playing the game. So let's go and look at the whole village as a whole. The point I want to make is that everywhere we go, in all these soundings, all over the place, we find things that we say are absolutely Urartian. In particular, the use of this Egyptian blue pigment, a carbonate. We find this everywhere, in every building we find it. And you never find it in Mesopotamia, I might add. We find these particularly Urartian types of projectile points made in iron. We find Urartian pottery everywhere. And although the proportions vary, and these are the various fine wares and things that we found, this is that one that had the Assyrian pottery, the proportions may vary, but there is always some highly polished redware. The fortress has varying percentages because they keep finding caches of stuff, but at any rate, they're all participating in this material assemblage. If we look at the faunal evidence, bones preserve very well here, we find the same suite of animals in different proportions in each place. In this slide, the sheep and goat are in the yellow, and the cattle are in the purple, and you can see they're different proportions. The citadel has a lot more sheep and goat, also has a few wild animals, whereas the proportions in the outer town tend to favor more in the way of cattle. Quality of the meat, who's getting the femurs, who's getting the fingers, or the phalanges, shows that the citadel is getting the best stuff by far, The worst are all these public buildings that are close to the Citadel, and the settlement seems to get the sort of medium cuts of meat. And again, we did some statistical things on how bones line up, and this reinforces that the sheep and goat are primarily in the Citadel, and in the residence areas we get cow and even a certain number of dogs. Wild animals are apparently the preserve of the royal of the king. So, any rate, let me try to draw all this together. First of all, if there was planning, it wasn't very thorough. The government might have put a plan structure here and there in the outer town, but nobody is designing a plan for the entire outer town. Rich people and poor people are clearly living in close proximity to each other. And there is a diversity in how people are consuming things throughout the town. Everybody's sharing Urartian materials, but things are looking a little different. And I must point out that every housing area we looked at was different. We never found two houses that were exactly the same. So, you know, we have this uniformity and within it diversity throughout the entire town. And that's probably where I'd like to stop, but I have to point out this cautionary note that everything that we're getting is coming from the reign of one particular king, and he was not a typical king. So it may be that the picture that we see here from these cities of Rusa, son of Argishti, represent something completely different from what was the dominant pattern throughout most of Urartu's history. If so, we know almost nothing about the former, but we can be grateful for what we do know about Rusa's reign. Thank you. Mm-hmm.